Hello and welcome to Washington Game Changers. I'm Lori Hennessy, and this is our podcast that we do here at the League of Education Voters to talk about issues that matter in our region and specifically about people who inspire us in the region. So in the last year of doing this podcast, we've talked to some amazing, inspirational people in the greater Puget Sound area. And I'd like to add these guys to my list, and I'm going to introduce them to you. Tony Allison and Joe Hunter Jr., welcome.
Thank you. Hello.
So we're here to talk. Well, there's many things we could talk about, but let's start with talking about the organization that the two of you run and how that came together. So let's start with that. Who wants to start with the introduction of what you do?
Go ahead, Tony.
All right. I'll start from the beginning, or what is kind of the beginning. There's a little prehistory to that, but the beginning really was after George Floyd was killed. And the country was in upheaval. A number of my friends and myself, who had been friends for 50, 60 years, group of white guys, basically, who played a lot of sports together, were very upset. And we were on a Zoom call together and talking about what was going on and how upset we were and that we wanted to do something about it. And so it was suggested that we reach out to our Black classmates from Roosevelt High School 50 years ago, because we were approaching our 50th reunion, and see if they'd be willing to engage in a dialogue for us to learn more about race and personal experiences of race as experienced by our Black classmates. So I got hold of Joe Hunter, who I'd played basketball with for 3 years at Roosevelt back in the day, and he agreed to bring together several Black classmates, people from Roosevelt, and we ended up having our first session, and Joe developed a little agenda for it, which was for each person to go around the room, each person, a Zoom session, of course, each person to talk about their own experiences, particularly one experience of racism or race that they'd encountered that was meaningful to them, and why they wanted to be there in this discussion. So we had that first meeting, and first of all, everyone, I think, enjoyed seeing each other after so long and had a lot to talk about, but we got down to it pretty quickly and pretty seriously. It was emotional, and we valued it. So we decided we'd do it again. And we had, I don't know, maybe three of those sessions or four. And then we started to kind of coalesce as a group and asked ourselves, should we try to actually do something besides discussions? And that led us to form what we then named Roosevelt Alumni for Racial Equity, RARE. And we started to take on three projects to start with. First was scholarships at Roosevelt High School for students of color. We started to raise money for that and gave it the name of our former classmate, African-American classmate who passed away in 2013. The second thing is we started to make a film, which eventually became a film that came out in just this past January called The Roosevelt High School Beyond Black and White, an educational documentary film. And then last thing is we decided to make these discussions, open discussions, and bring in speakers and invite the public to attend. And so those were the first three projects, and I'll stop talking there and let Joe tell his side of it.
I'll just pick up where Tony started off here, talking about the initial conversation, because I think it was it's important. When Tony contacted me, first of all, Tony and I, as he said, we played basketball for 3 years together and went to Roosevelt, but we really didn't know each other. You know, we played basketball together, and then we went our separate ways, after the games or what have you. But when I received a phone call, the first question I asked Tony was why? Okay. The George Floyd killing, I would say for most people, it was a shock. I mean, to see a grown man on TV crying for his mom and being killed right there. Was a shock to most. But I would tell you that For most people of color, it wasn't a surprise. I can tell you that for most of my life, I've heard stories of things like this happening, maybe not to the same degree, but things like this happening. But there was never any video. And so finally we had a video on it. So when Tony contacted me, the thing that I had on my mind was when someone sees something like this, it becomes very emotional. And so with this, was this an emotional response that, you know, after a couple months, a year or whatever, you know, it's no longer the shock that it was initially. And so, now it becomes something that we speak about, but doesn't have the same impact. But in talking to Tony and later with the discussions that we had, I felt that the group that we had really were concerned and really were wanting to do something special and different in terms of improving racial equality. And I felt that with this group that we had, Roosevelt alumni, and the success that each person had had in their particular field, and the their web of influence that they had outside of the group, that we could get some things done. Okay. And, you know, like Tony said, you know, we had a lot of discussions, conversations, and it was interesting to see how different each one of us raised. Okay. And I'm not going to go into the stories of this, but it was different. We started something, I think, that's very unique with most organizations, because we are close to being 50-50, 50% white, 50% people of color, close to being 50% female, 50% male. So, and we hold ourselves accountable for that, and it's in our bylaws. So we're not just talking about what we want to do. We're hoping to, we're showing what we want to be by the people that we have in our group and so forth and on that. But the scholarship was very important for me because the person that's named after James A. Davis Jr. Was my best friend from the time we were very young to going all the way through college. And later, he was my best man at my wedding. And I was his best man. He's my son's godfather. I was his son's godfather. I knew his wife very well. I knew his whole family well. And so to name the scholarship after him had a special purpose, you know, for me and motivation for it and so forth. The documentary was also important from the standpoint of being able to tell our story. Mm-hmm. And most people watching it, if they watch it one time, they'll walk away, I think, with one impression. But you need to watch it, you know, two, maybe even three times to really get the core of what we're talking about. And I think that for me anyway, the most important thing is that after 50 years, okay, nothing really has changed. And, you know, one of the tops that I bring up is ethnic studies. You know, I remember when I was in college and in high school, we wanted more books, history books that dealt with Black history, you know, included in the library there at Roosevelt. In fact, I believe there was a protest at one point there. When I was in college, we actually closed down the school in order to get more ethnic study professors to teach there at Western Washington University up there in Bellingham and so forth. And then here we are, you know, 50 years later, talking about, you know, the need for history, you know, not ethnic history, not Black history, not Asian history, but American history. We're talking about it. And it's amazing that, 50 years later that we'd have the same issues that that we're talking about then as we're talking about right now and so forth. So while there's been some progress, there really hasn't been enough progress, I don't think, to really move the needle as much as it needs to be made and so forth. And the other thing for the documentary, besides that point, was I think it was one of the teachers that was interviewed, Tula, and he said, the key to it is education. Because with education, once you do it, you're done. you know, this generation that is coming up behind us, okay, if they get it, it's done. They can fix it at the very foundation to have the type of impact. Our generation, Tony and I's generation, we've done some, but not enough. We need this next generation that's still in school to step forward and to recognize that something as simple as everyone being treated equal shouldn't be something that's extra. It's just, hey, no matter who you are, whatever color you are, whatever religion, whatever your preference or sexual preference is, whatever it is, you know, you should be treated as an equal. So anyway, we at Rare, we're learning. You know, some of the things that we're talking about, there's organizations that have been working on it for several years. And, you know, we don't want to reinvent the wheel. We just want to hopefully help the wheel move a little faster. So anyway, I'll leave it with that.
So let's go back if we can. So when you went to school at Roosevelt, one of the things that I saw from the documentary that, Joe, you really drive home is 50 years later, what is our progress truly in terms of schools that serve all students equally? What was it like going to Roosevelt back when you were there? How did it feel? Because this was during the formal busing era, was it, in the Seattle schools?
Right.
What was that experience like for each of you?
You want me to go first, Tony, or you want to go first? Okay. Well, for me, and you got, I'm 68 years old now, looking back, you know, 50, 51 years ago. And so now when I look at things, I see things obviously much different than they were in real time when I was at school. But I would tell you that, Roosevelt for me wasn't really any different. You know, there were enough of our students of color that, we were able to, when we wanted to be around those that looked like us and had some similar backgrounds, we could do that. Okay. And we would go in the lunchroom and we'd get in our own little, Alan said, you know, we'd have a coffee break. Okay. With that. But then there was opportunities to step outside of that, you know, if a person wanted to become part of, you know, some of the groups or organizations there at the schools and so forth. You know, I play basketball. And so I play basketball. I go to basketball practice. I had a relationship with a couple of ball players and so forth, and went to a couple of parties, whatever, outside of that. But I continued to go to the parties in the central area when I went there too. So it wasn't, the academics really wasn't that much harder, to be honest with you, because of the class schedule and so forth. And so I really didn't have any incidents or anything there. I think it's looking beyond that, I think it gave me the experience of having grown up in a predominantly Black environment and being a majority in that Black environment, going to Roosevelt where you are no longer a majority, but you're part of a separate, I guess they call it minority group within there, just being different. Being different from that standpoint, but it wasn't totally different because, like I said, there were enough of us with the voluntary busing program by the time we got there that if we wanted to stay within our group, we could do that. Okay. And so a lot of the challenges or issues that they had prior to our getting to Roosevelt with larger numbers, we didn't have because we had larger numbers. And we had, like I said, these groups that we could go to.
Well, from my side, I grew up in a neighborhood, Laurelhurst, that was all white. And looking back in elementary school, there were no African-American kids. There were a couple of kids that today we'd say kids of color who I think were international, came from UW, parents were UW nearby. And when I got to middle school at Eckstein, it was junior high school then, there was a very small group of African-Americans kids who'd come up. And since I played a lot of sports, I got to know them that way. Again, very few. And when it got to Roosevelt, that group was bigger and included Joe and James Davis and others. Again, I played football and basketball. So that's how I knew my African-American classmates, sometimes in the classroom a bit, but you know, this high school classroom. And, you know, I'm a high school kid and I'm totally focused on sports and, you know, my own little life. And all my friends were white. Now, I remember at Roosevelt, my senior year, they offered an elective in African-American history taught by a Black teacher. And I took that class. And by senior year, I was sort of waking up to the big world. And I remember Joe was in the class. And that was an eye-opener for me, because we were looking at history differently than I'd ever learned it before. So the thing is, I never really understood or appreciated that these classmates and teammates were getting on a bus or even driving, but coming a long way every day and back. So I would get up, you know, I'd be 10 minutes from school, 10 minutes home. So I think I still lived in a bubble, but the bubble was starting to get thinner and starting to break in some ways, fortunately, by the time I left. And in retrospect, you know, I just have to be thankful that Joe and others, this was voluntary busing, it wasn't mandatory. They volunteered and came to Roosevelt, which changed my experience and also allowed this to happen 50 years later, the formation of an entity that we share.
What were you in, as Joe, you mentioned the video, the documentary really is worth seeing. And, you know, at least once, twice is a good idea, because I had that same sense when I saw it. What was the first thought when you came up with the idea of telling part of this story in a documentary and reaching out to people to talk about this experience of this group coming together 50 years later? What were some of the original incentives for developing the documentary? Like, what do you want people to take away from seeing that? Some of the thoughts.
Well, the target audience of the documentary was white parents and white students. Okay. I know we never say that there, but Tony knows that was our target audience. And so it was to understand that, I don't want to say a lot, but some of the issues that we face today, okay, and that we faced 50 years ago, there's a reason why. Okay. You know, whether it's the fact that there was redlining, okay, and the impact that had then and then carried forward 50 years later, or whether it's the fact that Blacks or people of color could get loans, okay, or whether it was the fact that the school district was not hiring Black teachers or teachers of colors, okay, was to see that the situations that we have today didn't just happen, and that you could draw parallels of things that were laws and policies that were in effect then that had an impact and continue to have an impact on the things that we have today. And to understand that with the voluntary busing program and what it is that they wanted to accomplish with the voluntary and eventually mandatory busing program was just to get the numbers right. No one really cared that Black and white students would go together and how do we integrate the two together and so they get to know each other as individuals. It was just that this mandate was out there, a potential mandate was out there that said you've got to have X amount of students of color and X amount of white students in the school. That was it. And so With that, there was majority of the students that participated in the transfer programs were students of color. Okay. White parents fought it legally all the way from almost the very beginning until finally, and I don't know the exact year, but the year where they won the court case, 1986 or something like that, and the mandatory bus program was gone, was taken away. So it telling the story to understand the what we were trying to say was that look at what policies or things or things that were done, okay, in the past, its impact on the future, and understand the degree that individuals will go to keep us separate. Okay. And if you have means, financial means, and you can hire some of these best attorneys that are out there, okay, and you don't see the benefit of this voluntary transfer program to you or to your kids or whatever, and you don't like it, you can fight it and you can change it. You know, and I'll just add that I think to a large degree that's kind of what we're seeing now is within the schools, the majority of the schools and the majority of the decisions that are being made are being driven by white parents' interests, as opposed to a balance between parents of color and white parents, the two together.
Anything to add to that, Tony?
Well, Joe said it really well. I might only add that the original inspiration for the film was also rare. And that what had happened with us getting together 50 years later and thinking that could be a pretty good model for other groups, maybe other alumni groups, mm-hmm. student groups, that you can spontaneously decide to get together and accomplish things on behalf of racial equity as a racially mixed, pretty much evenly divided group like we were. And I think as it evolved, and Joe knows, we had endless discussions and sometimes arguments about what direction the film should take. I don't mean just me and Joe, there were other people involved, and we ended up working it out. But it's, you know, we hadn't been through that before. I certainly hadn't, you know, making a film and deciding where it's going to go. But what Joe said is true. The primary audience we thought was white parents and white students. The fact that Roosevelt High School, just like it was 50 years ago, is basically more or less in a bubble. A lot of it mm-hmm. is anyway, the kids who go there. And mm-hmm. and here we are, you know, we went through this high school years with all the upheaval, the late 60s, early 70s, racial upheaval included. And then here we are looking at it. And for those kids and parents to realize some of that background, why is it that Roosevelt High School is white? This background Joe was talking about with the redlining and the covenants. And, mm-hmm. you know, it's not an accident. The narrator says that in the film, this is not accidental. This was intentional. And the other thing it showed was besides fighting, busing in the courts, a lot of them fled to the suburbs or to private schools. Mm-hmm. That's all history that affects Seattle and its schools today. And so kind of to bring it out and we thought for a while of trying to provide solutions, you know, mm-hmm. and we realized that what we really want to do was pose the questions for discussion and then let people decide what actions they want to take.
So if a group watches the video, whether it's a PTA or, and let's not even get started on PTAs. And I say that, by the way, as a former PTA president in my community, I'm very cognizant now how PTAs feed into this disparate public education we have, where there are wealthy communities where they're raising $100,000. And anyway, that's a whole different next podcast. But if you were to have a viewing of a PTA or some community group, what do you think would be the discussion questions that you would hope they can sort of open up with? So they watch this video and they're all sitting there processing. What's one of the questions that you might use to get them to sort of think about what they just saw? Is one of the questions, are things any better? than they were for students in some of our schools in 50 years ago? Or what's one of the questions?
I could start with that saying, first of all, on the website, for those ever interested, on our website, there is a list of 10 discussion questions for groups to work with. And they're all designed to do that, to have people dig deeper into it and not just into the issues they see, but into what it means for them and their city and their schools. But I would think that, that's the thing, is to say, okay, now we understand a lot better what's going on and where it comes from and what can we do about it. Now that goes to a lot of different things that could be done about it. It goes to the geography and zoning of the city. It goes to housing costs in different parts of the city. And, to some extent, it goes to the ways that schools are run, the tracking, the, like you said, the unequal PTSA funding of schools.
Dance classes.
Yeah, we know about that. Well, one good thing about this film is one of the main viewers has been PTSA groups. Mm-hmm. And on May 21st, it's going to be shown and discussed as one of the sessions in the statewide PTSA conference in Linwood. So, and they've invited us to participate in that.
Nice.
So it is getting out there. I mean, it's not getting out as broadly as we would like it to. We'd like it to be everywhere. PTSAs are a good starting point as well as schools, but that's not an overnight process.
Yeah.
Start asking the questions, asking of each other. And, so far the reception has been pretty good. People say it stimulated a lot of not just questions, but a little bit of soul searching as to what can be done.
Yeah.
I agree with what Tony just said, as Tony knows, we've had, been part of quite a few discussions with different groups on the documentary and so forth. And I think that the question that I would pose to them is, what parts of this documentary can you personally, relate to?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And how has it changed your opinions about things? And then what will you do as a result of it? And I think that too many of the discussions we have, we want to talk about broad issues, okay, about things that can be done. And these discussions need to take place. But it starts with the individual, okay? The individual understanding, hey, I didn't know that, or now I do know, or whatever it is. And then understanding, okay, what do I need to do to change? Mm-hmm. And then what impact can I have within my sphere of influence or whatever? So my question would be directed toward the individual, not their being part of another or larger organization, but the individual. How's it going to change you?
That's great. I just saw the clock. I could talk to you guys for a long time, but we're getting near the end. So can we share what's the best website to go to if people want to find out more about the video or about RARE, which stands for Roosevelt Alumni for Racial Equity?
Yep. Yes.
Okay. Oh, you're on mute, Tony. Come back. There he is.
Yep, there right. We are. Sorry. The website is RHS4 racialequity.org.
RHS for racialequity.org.
That's right. Then the four right. Being the numeral.
We will share that in with this podcast when we share it, and we'll be sending it out there to plenty of folks and make sure that website is everywhere.
Can I just add that if you click there and then you'll quickly be led if you want to be to the film, and you can download the film and view it right from there as well as see those discussion questions and curriculum.
That's great. Okay, so I always like to add one last kind of uplifting question at the end of our podcast, because there's just a lot of stuff out there in the world. What's one thing, Tony, that has inspired you about Joe, either during high school or now? One thing that you think people should know about him?
Well, I could talk about basketball, but I'll stay away from that and say that, I mean, like Joe said, we didn't know each other really when we started this thing. We know each other. We've been spending a lot of time together, mostly on Zoom, in the past almost 2 years now. I could talk for quite a while about this, but I think the biggest thing is Joe's dedication. And he's able to do it and work incredibly hard. I mean, I don't even know how many hours he puts in, but I know something about it. But he's also humble about it. And, he's not judgmental. He's warm and outreaching with every audience and every interaction that we have. So I'd say two things, that combination of dedication and human contact that he has.
Nice. Joe, your turn.
Okay. Well, I would say, Tony is, again, dedicated, committed. In business terms, he's what we call a driver. he's a person that that gets things done. And, I appreciate that, his commitment and his drive and so forth. And, he's a person that will also listen. Okay, when there's different points of views and so forth. And we've had different points of views and all the different meetings that we've been to and so forth. And yet here we are. We're still friends and what have you. But now, like I said, he's a driver. He's a person that really cares. And once he commits himself to something, he's committed. And, he's a great person, great individual. I wish I knew him back in high school like I know him now.
Wow, that's a great way to wrap it up. And I am so embarrassed, I don't know this. Is it the Roosevelt Rough Riders?
Yes.
Okay. Wow, I do know it. Okay, so go Rough Riders. and thank you to you both for doing this. You've inspired me, and I hope that we can continue to find ways to partner up between League of Education Voters and RARE as well, because this is not easy work, but it's very, very important work. So thank you so much for doing it.
Okay, thank you.
All right. Well, thanks again. We will be sharing the link to this when we share the podcast. And thanks to everyone for listening to our latest Washington Game Changers. And we'll be back next month with more. Thank you.